Hello, and welcome to Leadership Amplified. I'm Dr. Karen Morley, and I'm delighted to bring you another podcast episode that profiles leaders who are great role models, who inspire us to continue to be curious about what good leadership is like, and who show us and tell us how to lead well. My guest for this episode is Angela Williams, who's general manager at what was Broad Spectrum and is now Ventia. Angela is an accomplished leader with significant experience driving growth and performance improvement in complex projects across multiple industries. She has a passion for safety, customer service, and equality. Her current role sees her leading a portfolio of projects in excess of $250 million. She led the company's COVID incident management team earlier this year, 2020, and this is something that we're going to be exploring in our conversation. Angela has held a number of contract management and commercial roles over her career in Australia, the Middle East, and Asia. Her industry experience is broad. Besides infrastructure, she's worked in strategy, banking, and she interned at Coca-Cola Amatil. Angela has a Bachelor of Commerce in Accounting and Finance, and an MBA from SDA Bocconi in Italy, and that included an exchange with the prestigious University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Besides her formal education, Angela has also completed leadership programs with Chief Executive Women and the Cape York Partnership. Angela, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Karen. It's great to be with you too.
Yeah, thanks for giving up your time for this. I'm very excited to be interviewing you today. And let's kick off with your own leadership journey, the challenges that you faced along the way, and what helped you to be as successful as you are as a leader today.
Thanks, Karen. Yeah, it's been a strange journey to where I am at the moment. As you mentioned, I started out with a commerce degree, and now I'm running a fairly significant operation spanning a lot more than just a commercial discipline. And I have had experience working in different jurisdictions. So each of those elements has definitely thrown up challenges. I think the Middle East was my first real foray into having a leadership role and having a real team working or leading a team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really had to force me to learn about, you know, the difference between managing and leading and working out what are the tools that I have in the toolkit to be a successful leader that doesn't necessarily mean leading from the front. Mm-hmm. And the Middle East culture, was very respectful, and I was very, well regarded in my roles. But in some cases, it did require other people to present opportunities or present presentations because the format culturally was better received through someone who may have been in my broader team, whether or not that's an Australian male, that's a Indigenous Arab working in the region, or depending on who the audience was. So certainly that culturally diverse Middle Eastern experience gave me a lot of challenges, but a lot of opportunities to figure out that leadership doesn't always mean leading from the front, and certainly not transactional. So that was a great opportunity, which I really, really enjoyed. The other piece to the Middle East was, in some cases, and I was, younger than 30 at that point, I would quite often be the most senior person in the region because of the tyranny of distance back in Australia. So it really did teach me a lot about how to self-regulate and manage some of the issues and prioritize things because, we had a number of businesses that all needed assistance, and sometimes you were the most senior person. So it enabled me to learn a lot more than just my discipline and really step out and say, what does a leader do? It might not necessarily solve the problem, but it gives that person the ability to talk to someone, coaching, you know, someone to listen to help them develop their strategy and plan of attack. So that was a great opportunity in and of itself, and definitely was challenging because sometimes those problems in regions were difficult to solve.
Yeah. And I mean, that sounds like quite a big challenge very early in your career. Mm-hmm. There are two questions I have about that. One is, you know, what prepared you for that or supported you in that developmental stretch that you experienced? Mm-hmm. And the other thing, which may or may not be related, but where did you get that wisdom about what kind of leader you wanted to be?
So two great questions. The stretch, I think I had a good team. I had a good team of confidence in my kind of inner circle in the region, mm-hmm. which enabled me to develop my own support networks so I could in turn support from a leadership perspective. And that old adage of, you know, it's difficult to support when your cup is empty. And making sure you've got that network of people who in and of themselves can support you and have that reciprocity. Equally, that was also outside of work. So having that work-life balance and having the support network for myself on a personal level made those challenges, while they may have been difficult to face, you know, or helped contextualize and have that out of professional life, you know, where you can get that sense of balance.
So you're paying attention to keeping the cup full, both from a work perspective, but also a, you know, personal outside of work perspective.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. And the other piece was I didn't have any hesitation to know where my strengths or my ability to lead capped out. So was very happy to escalate when I felt needed. And I think understanding that point was helpful. And over the time that I was there, which was nearly 4 years, I felt that, you know, experience grow and that point, you know, keep moving to the right. And so could feel that development. In terms of, you know, what leaders I would like to be, that opportunity gave me a lot of insight into maybe sometimes what type of leader I didn't want to be.
Well, it's a good learning experience.
and the people that I worked for and with were fantastic, and living an expat lifestyle, you know, you have that support network, like I mentioned. But you also got insight into what else was happening in different organisations that had that same expat tyranny of distance. And sometimes that reflection enabled me to say, okay, actually I'm in a pretty good circumstance because I can see over there that, you know, that's not working very well, and what are the things I can do to maybe tailor what we're doing to have better outcomes. I certainly like leaders who communicate, and that was definitely a learning in the Middle East, because the time difference, the tyranny of distance, the different cultural nuances that you're working with, and we were working across India, the Middle East, the Philippines and New Caledonia, so we were very, very diverse, but if you didn't have that communication, you could spin your wheels and spend a lot of time going off piste and not, you know, focused on the task if it wasn't clearly communicated. So having a leader who communicates, particularly when you've got that tyranny of distance, was something, you know, that was really at fore, and certainly, you know, taught me about what I need to communicate to others, or how I communicate, maybe I should say, to others.
Did you have any particular role models, or again, was it, I guess, a variety of different circumstances, different people around you that helped guide you?
The one that springs to mind actually was a gentleman who worked in my team, also fellow Australian, and he really provided that even keel, which I think helped. And I guess, you know, it helps emphasize the point that you don't always have to be in a leadership role to be a leader. And the ability to work so closely with someone to have that person who can even, you know, have that even keel and provide, you know, guidance when you might need guidance yourself, even though you might be in a different role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice support for the value of upwards mentoring and coaching, isn't it? You know, there are all sorts of ways in which you can be supported and developed, mm-hmm. and it's not always mm-hmm. one way down from the top.
It does raise a good point, Karen. I, you know, working in the Middle East as a female, I didn't feel as though there were lots of people in my network in similar roles that were female to look up mm-hmm. to, which does make me think about the importance of, you know, diversity being visible so people can see and have that engagement with someone who may be experiencing the same type of challenges in that setting.
Yeah. Yes.
Lots of fabulous women that.
Yeah, not necessarily in such senior roles. And you may be going on to talk about this, but I'm really interested in that shift out of, you know, your commerce degree that you mentioned early on into operational and commercial roles. And we know that can be quite challenging for women in particular to get those sorts of opportunities. And given that you mentioned it, I just wanted to go back to that because really keen to understand, you know, was that intentional? Was that accidental? And I know now from speaking with you, that's something that is really important to you and something that's an important part of your career. So how did it come about?
So I was working, when I returned from the Middle East, I was working on a very large government contract, highly politicised, and I was leading the strategy and commercial function. But the scale and size of that meant that I was very, very close and embedded into the operations, and that gave me by no means a soft entry, but a softer entry into having that visibility and hands-on operational experience. And through that contract, I was able to start those little steps of backfilling the general manager, leading the operations, which is a very, you know, you have the responsibility when you are in that role backfilling, but it's a very neat way to introduce someone to having that operational decision-making and rhythm responsibility. The first contract that I went to manage, I think, was perfectly aligned. It was a turnaround contract. So it had you know, an operational rhythm to it, of course, but it really had some commercial and strategic issues that needed to be worked through. And so that also was able to be an opportunity that used my strengths, that gave me then a lot of opportunities to learn around running a business, managing a blue collar workforce, either internal or extended through our subcontracted team, and also gave me a national operational viewpoint. So that really was a great opportunity for me to pivot from being seen as commercial, in a safe, somewhat safe environment, to then become an operational leader.
Mm, yeah. So some very interesting steps along the way. And what else, I guess, would you say about what your particular skills and capabilities have contributed to being successful and being able to make that shift?
Mm. Definitely the ability to communicate, particularly with clients in an operational sense, you know, no surprises is a pretty important phrase that you've got to live by, and having that communication with clients, with teams, with the organisation is very important. The ability to talk with everyone and get around and actually see, you know, who is delivering the services, who's part of your team, and really getting an understanding from their perspective around what they need to make the business better. I think that was something I, you know, really try and focus on, because I'm learning every day from the people delivering our services, from our teams. I think the other probably benefit was that I had people who were willing to take that risk, I say in inverted commas, on me in an operational sense. And I think I was, you know, looking back, fortunate to have people around me who were happy to take that risk, in inverted commas again. And certainly something that I'm very committed to is making sure that I don't take risks on people, because they're not risks. It's known that they'll be successful, but just allow people to have that opportunity to have that pivot into operations.
Fantastic. Anything else you would like to add around your leadership journey?
I think it wouldn't, it would be amiss of me not to say that, you know, unfortunately we still work in a world that has cultural or gender bias, whether or not that's conscious or unconscious. And certainly through my career, I feel I have been quite happy to assert myself and my capabilities and be my own person and try and create my own space. But I do still feel like we have those issues that we need to be mindful of and not assume that they're not challenges anymore, because they might look slightly different to what they maybe looked like a decade ago or two decades ago. So certainly a challenge, but one of the opportunities of that challenge is most companies realise that is still a challenge, and we've got the Sustainability and Inclusion Council, or Diversity and Inclusion Council, here at Ventia, which I'm a member of, to help continue to break down those barriers and some of those unconscious biases, which do, you know, really create barriers and challenges.
Thanks. Thanks very much. So now I'm interested in getting into this year's experience, this year being the sort of unprecedented year where we've all had to pivot. Your experience, though, this year was very interesting in particular, because you led the incident management team as part of Broad Spectrum at the time, the response to the COVID crisis. And that was a very special role. So you had some authority from the role, but not a formal authority. You needed to work right across the organisation with senior leaders, as well as getting things happening operationally right across the business, in different parts of the business. And so tell us, what did you learn about leading, and perhaps about yourself, if they're not the same thing, from that experience?
Yeah, it was, I mean, to start with, it was a phenomenal, fantastic experience, and I wouldn't trade it in a heartbeat, notwithstanding, you know, COVID. The challenge, challenge. Yes. You know, I think the ability to be within an organisation and get plucked out to try and lead across at the executive level a crisis that affects every single person on our professional work level, but also their personal lives, you know, going on at home, was a very interesting challenge. And I definitely, you know, reaffirmed to myself, I love challenges, I love problem solving, I love, you know, being part of a team and being able to kind of, you know, get in there and really understand how and develop a plan on how we're going to attack it. I think, you know, reflecting on the way that I responded, I think, you know, I do love problems where there's a call to action. I think it definitely affirms, you know, the type of work that we do and the industry that we work in, where, you know, people really are at the end of the services we provide or the, you know, the projects that we work on, and having that sense of obligation and responsibility and call to action really gave me a lot of energy, which I really enjoyed. I certainly, you know, am probably more disciplined than I give myself credit for in a leadership style. And that I think turned out to be a strength, to be able to kind of, you know, have a 12,000 person organization represented by a 20 something incident management team and get that operational rhythm and drumbeat running to deliver outcomes, and quite quickly deliver outcomes to ensure that our personnel continued providing services, which we did across Australia and New Zealand throughout the whole COVID period. So I think, you know, just having those, that ability to quickly put in a plan and get people on board with it, with that rhythm, was, you know, I probably would have doubted myself to say how quickly I could have done that, and particularly whether or not I could have done that for a very diverse organisation. The other piece that I learned, and it was more, someone told me this than my own observation, was that the style of response and the style of meeting that I had created in the incident team was very inclusive. Mm-hmm. So people, and you know, it was an interesting observation. So I've gone and sought more information to kind of learn around, you know, what that really meant and if people did feel included. And certainly that was the feedback, that the style I was able to bring in a very tense environment enabled people to be themselves through a crisis, which is always important, but B, feel like their voice and their part of the business voice was being heard to help deliver a solution, which, you know, is quite a nice reflection to learn through the process.
So what were some of the things that you did specifically that enabled that sort of very inclusive response at that very tense time? You know, people were very anxious then and not sure what to do. Things can go in a number of different directions. So to get that sort of closeness and cohesion, what were some of your tactics?
Mm-hmm. So a few things. The structure of the incident response team, I spent quite a bit of time just trying to get that right, so that people were, or parts of the organization were represented to have a voice. So that went across the different sectors that we deliver services in, but also the different parts of shared services, and then parts of the business that had key roles in delivering outcomes. So, for example, procurement was a significant part of our response because we needed PPE procured, which was very difficult to get, particularly back at the start of COVID. Equally, the finance team, and considering, you know, what are those impacts to the business overall, and how were we managing and monitoring some of those elements to make sure we could provide feedback to the executive and to the business around what the actual underlying impact of COVID was, and forecasting that out. So really tried to, first of all, get the right team in place. The second piece was developing tools quickly to communicate information in a very standard and structured way, so that everyone was looking at the same information and there was no Chinese whispers and there was no kind of ambiguity around what was happening within the organization. And it also enabled people to self-select when they wanted that information, rather than creating a, you know, a mountain of emails or correspondence trying to get the same information. So I guess that's a long way of saying really tried to work on the communication strategy and how we communicate to the incident management team, but also to the broader coalface, you know, the 12,000 people who deliver services who are going out every day during this period, as well as the comms plan to the executive team, and how do we keep them informed to give them comfort that you know, we really are enabling our staff to go and work safely in such a strange time.
And they're very much on the front line.
Very much on the front line. And then I think the other piece was, you know, really trying to set up a feedback loop. So the way that we structured meetings was, you know, it had a very, very, organized operational rhythm and drumbeat to it, but it enabled people to contribute and provide feedback. And then we would have working groups on particular issues of feedback. So nothing was ever shut down in those meetings. It was always raised in an open, transparent and safe space to do that, because each business was experiencing the crisis differently. But then we tried to bring the best of the company to solve that particular problem or work through that particular issue. And I think that feedback loop created a community amongst the incident management team who hadn't worked together before. We're talking about 20 or so people who had never met before. We were doing it all virtually. We created, you know, an IT platform that enabled people to communicate and chat and things. So we centralized the information, but having that feedback loop and the ability for people to raise issues did create quite a nice team in the end, which was good.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it sounds like, you know, psychological safety was a pretty important thing and somewhat harder to do, especially when you're responding very quickly, but also you're remote. Did you think specifically about psychological safety?
That's a good question. Probably I would not have coined it in that term.
Yeah.
We definitely spoke around, well, and I was very lucky to have a wonderful CEO who provided me guidance through the process. Mm-hmm. And you know, I had psychological safety with him, and I think that type of support enabled me to support others.
Okay.
Safety is a big piece of the broad spectrum. Mm. And now the Ventia DNA, including psychological safety. So I think I would not have thought about it as explicitly as that, Karen. Although over the period we did talk a lot about managing people's mental health. So we did shift to that being a focus, particularly because, you know, we were continuing to provide services and maintain employment. And in a lot of places, we actually increase services because of the nature of the work that we do. But people at home, their families were being impacted in lots of different ways. So what are the ways that we needed to support our workforce beyond just our own physical safety?
Mm. Yeah, mm. Yeah. So different term, but nevertheless part of the whole plan.
Mm. Yeah.
So three important leadership lessons there. Any others, any sort of insights into you? One of the things, I will let you answer that question, but one of the things that struck me when you talked about the first experience of leading in the Middle East was this idea of being quite flexible and the importance of, allowing somebody to step in to do this presentation because that was appropriate. And that I think one of the hallmarks of good leading that I see is that ability to do that, to be able to take different perspectives, to be able to take the viewpoints of another and to be, I guess, humble enough to say, actually, not me this time. Mm. There's an interesting sort of flexibility you have there, sort of stepping back and out and around, and then in the COVID crisis, stepping right in to be very clear about how was this team going to work best together to respond to what was happening now. So there's a sense in which there's a very humble description of what you did, mm-hmm. but also a real clarity about what was important and why it was important.
Mm-hmm. And how that changed over the time too.
Mm.
So we deconstructed the COVID response into three phases. And the first phase was respond. You know, what do we need to do to respond right now to get our people to continue to deliver essential services safely? And we had a lot of tools. I mentioned the reporting tools and tools. We created a hub where people could call for assistance and to report issues. So we really focused on what is that response and the tools, and that was very rapid. And then we moved into the sustain phase, which was, you know, probably six weeks or 8 weeks later, because response took quite some time as the legislation changed to adapt. And the sustain phase became, you know, a lot more around compliance and making sure that we were doing what we were saying we were doing and keeping those high standards in place. And then the last phase was reimagine. So what are the learnings? What are the creative and innovative things that we've done as an organisation to adapt that we want to take into the future? And each of those iterations had a need for a different type of response from me. And you know, I would love to say that I'm really innovative, but that last phase, you know, we needed all hands on deck to really understand what are those interesting things that our teams at the front line came up with to adapt, and how do we adopt them in the future? So really shifting what a leader looked like through those three phases to try and get the best outcome for the phases. Certainly an interesting experience. I think I probably didn't realise how much I was pivoting through those different leadership styles, and particularly as those phases blended, the respond and sustain was completely iterative depending on what became the different state legislations and the borders and what was required. At one point, Western Australia was closed in regions, not even the border, but regions within WA, and we were responding to that. But that real pivot between those three styles for those three phases on a day, on a week, on an hour, depending on what was required, I think looking back was probably good to be able to have that agility to do that, even though I might not have been as conscious of it, what I was doing at the time.
Brilliant. And as we think about the future, and let's hope there are fewer crises in it, at least for a little while. Given what you've learned and what you've experienced in your career, what lessons would you like to share for younger women or younger people who are seeking a career in leadership?
A couple of things. I think understanding that management and leadership are very different, and leadership doesn't necessarily have to come with a management role. And the more I think you have the opportunity to step into a leadership role in early in your career, when you may not have that management delegation, I think the more opportunity will come to you, because people will see your ability to gather resources, to make decisions, to achieve outcomes, particularly when you don't have the power base or the DOA to do that. Be courageous. I think, you know, understanding your strengths and weaknesses is one thing, but stepping out of the comfort zone and being courageous and taking an opportunity or pushing yourself forward for an opportunity, I would highly, highly recommend. I think I was, I've been fortunate to work in different parts of the world in different industries, and I believe none of it would have come from not being courageous and not stepping out and putting my hand up and being willing to kind of take on something that I wasn't always sure that I had the capability set to do. Look for non-obvious moves. I think if you want to move around, or if you want to become a general manager, or if you want to have a career aspiration as a particular, you know, role that you can see in your sights, having a depth of capability and experience in doing something outside of your subject matter expertise, I think is very, very valuable and can even set you off on a completely different path that you may enjoy even more. So look for those non-obvious moves. And if you're in a functional area, I would highly suggest that you make every effort to go out and experience operations, go and do site visits, go and talk to contract managers, talk to them about what their problems are so that your, you know, your operational intelligence is accumulating all the time and gives you a different kind of capability for to put your hand up for a non-obvious move. And the last piece is, Find a network, mentor, sponsorship group. And it doesn't have to be one person. It can be a panel of people. It can be a group of people who are your confidants, who you can talk to, who you can bounce ideas off. And equally, they can and talk to you about different opportunities or what they see, and, you know, giving constructive feedback to you about what your aspirations are. But, you know, seek out those networks, seek out that panel of sponsors who can help guide you and, you know, provide you opportunities and feedback that you may not have access to.
Fantastic. Well, just one last question on that. A very nice kind of mix of things to focus on for people earlier in their careers. The non-obvious moves. How do people recognize them?
How do people identify them in the business?
Yeah, especially, you know, when you earlier in your career, because you're usually coming out of a discipline background, a disciplinary approach, and you're developing your expertise in that. So in some ways, it's probably almost more difficult to see those opportunities that are outside the subject matter. What do you think might help people to be able to see them?
A couple of things. There's probably the first really obvious one is the type of company that you work in that will foster those types of non-obvious moves. And certainly some time ago in what was Transfield, which was then Broad Spectrum and now Ventia, there were identified non-obvious moves. Now, they were way above where I was at the time, but I could see the organisation supported people who, say, for example, had been leading contracts and operations for a long time, go in and work in the HR discipline because they had a lot of experience in managing large workforce and they had a lot of capability to bring to thinking about, you know, how we manage our people and culture differently. So I could see that in the organisation I worked for, which made me think about it more consciously. But the second thing I would say is talk to operations. I think you need to get out and see what it's like. Talk to people. And the more you talk to people, the more you'll see those opportunities emerging. And also you could go out to operations and realize that is not what you want to do. So that's a really safe way of not actually going into a non-obvious move thing that you don't want to do that. But I think in the main, and I've had a lot of women over time ask me that, and my key suggestion is get out to operations, speak to people, talk about, you know, what you're doing, but in the main, really listen around. What are their problems? What are the really interesting projects that they're working on? What would they really love to see happen in their contracts or their operations? And then start to think about how you might be able to use your skill set in a creative way that they never would have thought of that might help them solve that problem.
Brilliant. That's a great suggestion. It's really very much about being open, but getting out to the rest of the organisation, not just staying in your area and seeing what's there and finding out more. That's great. That's terrific. So, Angela, is there anything that you thought you'd like to say or that's occurred to you along the way that I've not given you the opportunity to say?
No, you always give me great opportunity to talk, Karen. So, I think... You know, I probably keep coming back into the leadership style that might work at the time may not work another time. And it's that adaptability and the ability to navigate what leader you need to be in what circumstance or situation or for the project or for other people's development as well. It's not always about your leadership. And I think one thing that, you know, I've learned a lot working with you is that coaching piece, you know, as opposed to being that manager piece, and how you have an obligation, or I feel have an obligation, on making sure that that leadership capability is cultivated throughout the organisation and people see you still learning in that leadership role.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and your story and hearing some more about your career, and I'm sure that the listeners have really enjoyed your reflections. So thank you very much. And to the listeners, thank you for joining Leadership Amplified. It's been a pleasure having you here, and look forward to the next conversation. Take care.